東の空が散らむとき、お前は何を叫ぶのか、名もない人の小さな夢を奪うやつなら。
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday the 13th of January in the glorious future year of 2024. And what does that mean, folks? Well, it means, among other things, that I have a show for you today in which I will talk about, the usual. Greetings to everyone in calm and everyone listening who's not in calm. But yes, what does the usual consist of this week? Let's see, I could complain a little bit about some computer trouble I had, which turned out to be down to the manufacturer of a certain model of PCI card, PCIe, but, you know, an internal expansion card for a desktop computer, which, yes, I have. That's what I'm using right now. Yes, desktop computer. Having completely changed a card. You know, the chipset is totally different, etc. And they're selling it under the same name. It's just, you know, a different revision. Well, usually different revision doesn't mean that you change what drivers it uses, how it interacts with the system, etc. So that was exciting. I've managed to find a used one, and I'm hoping that it will work fine. I could also mention that I seem to have gotten into it again a little bit on Mastodon with some people who have this weird idea, which is very widespread, and I don't understand it in the slightest, this weird idea that the raw materials used for wind and solar come from some special secret second virtuous supply chain so that they do no damage, right, in being mined and manufactured and so on, whereas the raw materials used for nuclear energy come from some, you know, from the bad supply chain, from the old dirty industry and not the new clean industry. I'm sorry to tell you, friends, there's only the one, and the more you dig out, if you dig out 10 times more, you do 10 times more damage to the Earth. That's just how it is. And the plain fact is that for well-known physical reasons, nuclear energy is always going to use much less in the way of raw materials than wind and solar can. You know, again, if you wanted to duplicate the amount of kilowatt hours per year produced by the Hinkley Point C nuclear power plant under construction in Britain, which is a single 1,600 megawatt unit, you'd need to build, let's say, 500 of 10 megawatt wind turbines, which are the largest size now considered practicable, each one requiring a mast 150 meters tall, half the height of the Eiffel Tower, right, and the blades are about 120 meters long. Anyway, and it seems obvious that winding a single 1600 megawatt turbo alternator involves a great deal less copper and a great deal less labor than winding 500 10 megawatt alternators. You know, the amount of copper and labor required for an alternator does not increase anything like linearly with output. And then, of course, you have the fairly obvious point that the nuclear plant produces its kilowatt hours on demand all year round, whereas the wind machines do not. Particularly in a place like Britain, it's a fairly small island, with the result that the weather patterns are fairly correlated. And if the wind isn't blowing in one place, it's likely not blowing anywhere else. So you need some kind of storage scheme. And I hate to tell you this, but the raw materials for batteries are not clean or cheap or available without human or environmental cost. Again, that seems to be another fable of the green movement. Oh, we'll use battery storage. Have you ever looked at battery storage? For that matter, one of the things that environmental campaigners love to protest against are lead smelters recycling old batteries. But is that what I came here to talk to you about? No. I also didn't come here to talk to you about the draft, though. I'm sorry. That's only a very vague Arlo Guthrie reference. So you may not have heard this, but I certainly heard it. Well, I didn't hear it out the window. I wasn't close enough to downtown, but there was a gas explosion earlier this week in Fort Worth. At least that's what they think it was. An explosion which wrecked the kitchen of a restaurant in a hotel downtown and did considerable damage to the hotel, started a fire, all those kinds of things, injured 21 people, and there's still one that they're not sure she's going to live. You know, badly injured and badly burned. And this makes me think about the way that opponents of nuclear energy, in particular, of course, the energy and environment minister in Germany, whose job it seems to be just to repeat this statement at any opportunity, always refer to nuclear energy as a high-risk technology. And it doesn't really seem to be borne out by the facts that when you look at gas, which something like half of all American households have gas service to the home, right? People just accept it as a normal fact of life. Well, what are the risks inherent in gas? Hold on a moment, I've got to fetch my notebook where I have this written down from the other side of the desk. Careless of me, I was going to grab that before the show, and then I started making edits on a document instead. Okay. So, in the newspaper, they were, because of this, they were printing statistics. And, let's see, where do I have it written down here? Ah, yes. So, it is estimated that there are 122 deaths and 603 injuries in the USA from 2010 to 2021 due to gas explosions. Now, how many people were killed by nuclear power accidents in that period of time? Zero. How many people were killed in the period 1957? We'll start with 1957, when the first U.S. civil nuclear power reactors started up. How many people have been killed by civil nuclear power reactor accidents in the USA in that period? Right? All the way from 1957 up to the present day. And the answer is no. None. I mean, no. So that's an interesting, right? That's an interesting question. Adam D. talking about his storage batteries. I have a friend who's probably listening to this who lives in a travel trailer, has since like 1980, and has a couple of great big storage batteries that she floats on. And she's in no illusion about the economics and practicality of having everybody in the country float their homes on batteries, much less all the industries, right? You see a thing, new nuclear power plant will provide power for 6 million homes, to which my response is, what's more to the point, it'll provide power for industries. Arg. People just don't seem to get it. Anyhow, but yeah, Hochrisikotechnologie, the Germans like to say, high-risk technology. I'd like them to show me what these risks are. You know, when Ralph Nader was campaigning against the Davis-Bessey nuclear power plant in Ohio, he said, and these are his words, right, an accident at Davis-Bessey would destroy half of Cleveland and leave the survivors envying the dead. Now, what basis did that ever have? None whatsoever. There was no warrant for saying anything like that. It was just something that he made up because it sounded frightening, and he wanted to frighten people, I guess. Why would you want to frighten people about something when the worst things you can come up with to say about it are all things you've totally fabricated? Ha! I don't know. It doesn't seem like a reasonable course of action to me. If you have to fabricate things for people to be afraid of, maybe you shouldn't be trying to make people afraid of them. Seems straightforward, doesn't it? But the thing was, in a particular case of Cleveland, have you ever heard of the 1944 East Ohio Gas Company disaster? You probably never have. But in the late autumn of 1944, when the Hanford production reactors in Washington were already running at full power, roughly a gigawatt each, producing plutonium for the Manhattan Project, although, of course, that was a closely guarded secret, deep, dark secret. Even people working on the site mostly didn't know what was going on there. Right. But after nuclear energy was being produced in a big way in the United States, a liquefied natural gas storage tank on the outskirts of Cleveland ruptured. And part of the gas evaporated, and one of the largest fuel-air explosions in history then eventuated, which demolished, completely razed to the ground, some 2.5 square kilometers of Cleveland. And the gas which didn't evaporate drained down into the sewers and kept coming up through sewer vents over the next couple of days, producing fires which were, as a result, essentially impossible to extinguish. The number of people killed was much smaller than you would expect. Only about 150. From what I can tell, the reason is it was wartime, of course, so everyone was working. You know, men and women, men who weren't in the army were working, women were working, kids were at school. It was the middle of the day in a largely residential area. And I think the reason that there was a largely residential area adjacent to a natural gas storage complex was simply that it had been built on the outskirts of town and then the town had moved outward to engulf it. I'm not 100% sure of that, though, if somebody wants to check into that. Right. Check me up on that. But it was pretty awful. Big gabada boom, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, but gas is considered acceptable and nuclear is not. Gas is considered acceptable in terms of risk and nuclear is not considered acceptable in terms of risk. Try and wrap your head around that, because I sure can't. I think, well, this is not a new thing for me to say, but I think that the opponents of nuclear energy are being dishonest. And I think that it is in everyone's interest if we recognize that dishonesty. Well, speaking of people who are being dishonest, I said last week, and it probably came as a surprise to some of you, that the slave owners of the American South before the Civil War were not particularly racist in today's meaning of the term. And that probably sounds very strange and surprising. But the fact is, these large landowners did not hold millions of black people in slavery because they hated black people. They did it because it was to their advantage. They did it because they could get away with it. They would have treated anybody else the same way if they thought they could get away with it. Right? That's important. Anti-miscegenation laws were not enacted to preserve the sacred purity of white bloodlines. They were enacted so that men like United States Senator Strom Thurmond could father a dozen bastards on the black housemaids and never have to worry that they would come knocking demanding a share of the family wealth, because anti-miscegenation laws meant that legally they couldn't be a part of the family. Yeah, that's what it was all about. So yes, any belief in the inferiority of black people or whatever was entirely beside the point. It would be useful for the Southern slave owners, Southern landowners, right, for other people to believe that, but it didn't really matter if they believed it one way or the other. So I'll leave you to think about that for a minute and then draw some parallels, right? So if you see somebody, and this was something I ran across a mention of the other day, some wannabe Nazi, some Nazi sympathizer, shouting about how you should ally yourself with people who share your genes. What's going on there? Well, to some extent, right, all these people, they're taking some extreme position because they figure that some other people will identify with that extreme position, and then they'll have a close-knit group of people that they belong with. That's a big motive behind all extremism. It really, truly is. And a second component is that, for example, 23andMe and things like that have given people, the general public, a mistaken impression that there's a lot of genetic variation among humans, right? And that it means something, that one human population is genetically very distinct from another human population, which just ain't so. I mean, if you think about it, if you share 98 or 99% of your DNA with a chimpanzee, how much difference can there be between you and the King of Sweden or the King of Thailand? Very, very little. But people have become accustomed, like I say, because of DNA testing, which looks at really minute differences mostly, and because of talk in the press about, oh, well, there's a gene for this and there's a gene for that. There's not all that many genes in the human genome, and most of them, more than 90%, are shared with mice. So there can't be that much genetic difference between you and another human. There just can't be. There isn't room for it. So saying such and such person shares my genes, again, I suspect that people have become primed for this by Richard Dawkins' frankly pseudo-scientific selfish gene theory as well. But that's certainly not all that's going on, right? It's not just that people are taking an extreme position because they want to find other wackos to pal around with. It's not even that they are taking an extreme position because they want political power, because extreme positions may sometimes lead you to political power, but most of the time they don't. So what else is going on here? Well, you do have to take account of the fact there's a sect of yammerheads. That's the best description for them. Using the absurdly pretentious name of the Dark Enlightenment. And these are people who, generally speaking, they come out of computer programming and areas like that. And they are always talking about how the mass of humanity needs to be controlled, and the only way we can make progress is by some ghastly combination of, you know, monarchical capitalism, which seems to be sort of a deification of the Sysadmin as much as it is anything else. But one of the things these people start talking about is, quote, human biodiversity, the idea that some people have are genetically predisposed to one thing, one aptitude or what have you. Some people are genetically predisposed to another aptitude or another thing, what have you. And that's interesting, and prima facie seems like it might be worth exploring. But then they jump almost immediately to a very just sort of basic, very basic, you know, late Victorian racism, race theory, where they say, well, the blacks over here, completely ignoring the utter lack of anything corresponding to the mass noun, the blacks. Bluntly put, you know, if you just classify people by skin color, you find that you have, in the same bucket, you have, you know, Zulu from South Africa, you have Amharic people, Amhara people from Ethiopia, you have Australian Aborigines, who are genetically not any more like each other than any of them is like the King of Sweden, right? You know, it doesn't make any sense. These are categories that don't make any sense. And so, again, you have to say, for whose advantage is this, right? What are they gaining by saying this? Because taken at face value, it's gibberish, right? It must come from somewhere, because if you look at it for any point of, you know, and these are people saying, well, I'm your intellectual superior, so you should believe what I think, you know, and so on. And then they say some nonsense. And the only explanation, I mean, perhaps they're just getting high on their own supply, right? Perhaps they're just sniffing their own fumes, believing what they say about their own superiority. But the more probable answer is that they think it's advantageous somehow to promote these ideas. You know, and they make a bunch of other arguments that don't make sense if you carefully examine them. Great example of this being that, well, poor people are poor because they have low time preference. Now, this is an argument that basically says that poor people are poor because they are mentally or morally deficient. And the specific form of this mental or moral deficiency is that they're unable to exercise enough self-control to give up an immediate benefit in order to obtain a long-term benefit. That they're not going to spend money on education now in order to earn more later, that kind of thing. They're not going to buy expensive furniture now, you know, because that means they won't have to buy it again in 5 years. And there are a bunch of things wrong with this argument. But the thing about being poor is, it's the biggest thing about this argument is you can immediately see that it's an inversion of the facts, that being poor means that you're going to develop a low time preference. In other words, you're not going to buy good quality furniture if you've ever been evicted. That's it, right? That's the whole thing. If you've ever been thrown out on the street by a landlord who then either puts your furniture in the trash or keeps it for himself or sells it or what have you, you're not going to buy expensive furniture in order to not have to replace it down the line. You're going to buy the cheapest thing you can find because you have no assurance that you'll still have it when that investment matures, essentially. Being poor is the experience of having your investments taken away from you before they mature, essentially. Being poor is the experience of having to pay the penalty for cashing out the CD early rather than getting the interest on the CD. You're losing money to the bank rather than getting it from the bank, etc. Of course, poor people have low time preference. Of course, poor people are going to spend money on booze, right? Generally speaking, people don't become poor because they spend money on booze. Oh, one or two here and there, but in general, poverty is miserable. And so, of course, poor people, when they get a little money, are going to spend it on something that makes them feel good right now, rather than on something that will make their life better in the long term, because, to be frank, the poor person who thinks too much about the long term is likely to become suicidal. So, again, it's obvious, to me at least, that these people who are making these arguments are not making them in good faith. Then why are they making them? And another example, people will trot out this old claim that, well, black Americans have an average IQ of 70. Now, prima facie, this is absurd. Why do I say prima facie this is absurd? Well, simply put, 70 IQ, in my experience, that's kind of the borderline where you start having serious trouble doing daily tasks, taking care of yourself. And looking at the black American population, if the average IQ of the black American population were 70, then there'd be a hell of a lot of people who are basically unable to get up and do anything. Not just menial labor, right? We're not saying, oh, these people are only good for menial labor. No, we're talking about people who would be unable to dress themselves, unable to feed themselves and clothe themselves, and that is not what we see in the black American population. Therefore, either the IQ tests used are fatally flawed, the whole idea is fatally flawed, which some people argue, or the data collection methods that were used to obtain that result are fatally flawed, because the result that they got is obviously wrong. It's like if you said, well, you know, a nuclear power plant uses 100 times as much fuel as a coal-fired power plant. You know that can't be right, so whatever method it was you used to obtain that number must be wrong. Of course, I'm specifically thinking of the Storm-Smith study, which claimed that nuclear power has overall about the same emissions, right, carbon dioxide and such, as gas-fired power, based on their estimates for the amount of energy used in mining and transporting and milling uranium and enriching uranium and so on. I looked at the paper. I looked at the methods section. The methods section, almost in so many words, says, we just made up some numbers we thought sounded good. Now, do I have any real insight into why IQ tests on the black American population would come back with completely wrong numbers, numbers which are simply not consistent with observable reality? I don't. I can, however, say that for generations, simply being able to read was liable to get a black person killed in America, and so that probably has something to do with it. I'm not even saying that there's been genetic selection for low IQ, you know, or at least for avoidance of high IQ. I'm just saying that maybe black people underperform on certain kinds of tests because there's cultural pressure not to stand out in certain ways that would get you killed. I don't know. I'm not a sociologist, right? I'm not somebody with deep insight into American culture. I've lived here all my life, and frankly, all I can tell you is it's weird, and most of it I don't like. But it seems to me that there's a more fundamental problem here. Right, it seems to me there's a more fundamental problem here, which is who has the right to ask these questions? Who has the right to demand that black people justify that they have the right to vote? Who has the right to demand a free and open debate into whether women are allowed to show their faces in public? Right? My argument is nobody has the right to demand this. Nobody has the right to demand that people justify that they're human. Nobody has the right to demand that you prove that you're human, that you justify being treated like a human being. And that's why we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which came out of the period after the Second World War, when we saw just how bad it was to allow people to hold debates like that. Anyway, Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. I've got lots of postage for sending stuff back to you. I'll probably read your letter out on the air.